Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, my lovely betwixters. It's me, Kate Lister. I am here with your fair dues warning to protect you from yourselves and, most importantly, protect you from me and the kind of awfulness that I like to talk about on the airwaves. What are we talking about today? Well, we're talking about Churchill, which we're already into controversial territory. But we're talking about food, actually. We're talking about the kind of food that Churchill liked to eat. I don't think that's particularly shocking, but do you know what? You just might not want to listen to someone talking about food. Oh, and I'll definitely be swearing. Definitely. I don't think there's anything weirder than that, actually. So if you're all right with that, I'm all right with that. Let's do it! Picture the scene, betwixters. You are in your kitchen. You are serving up, a simple soup, perhaps some radish rosettes. I can't cook at all, so honestly, anything is impressive to me. But, back to the scene. You're waiting for your guests to arrive. But, these aren't just regular guests. No. They are kings, queens, world leaders, just generally really important people. Far more important than us plebs, anyway. And what ingredients do you have? What is it that you're working with? Well, rations, actually. Oh, and there's also air raids going on, and your kitchen has already been bombed. This chaotic scene would have been a regular occurrence for Georgina Landamer, who was the head of Winston and Clementine Churchill's kitchen from 1940 till 1954. Today, betwixt the sheets, I'm going to find out what this lady cooked, who she was, what it was like to work for the Churchills, and how the hell do you prepare a banquet feast in the middle of an air raid.
What do you look for in a man?
Oh, money, of course.
You're supposed to rise when an adult speaks to you.
I make perfect copies of whatever my boss needs by just turning a knob and pushing a button.
Yes, social courtesy does make a difference.
Goodness, what beautiful time. Goodness has nothing to do with it, dearie.
Hello and welcome back to Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal in society, with me, Kate Lister. For the cook Georgina Landamer, wartime work was just a little bit different than that of the rest of Britain. She was in the kitchen, trying to make the most out of her rations to cook the Prime Minister and his guests their favourite meals. But despite the thousands of books on Churchill, not much has been written about Georgina. So today I am talking to the one, the only, the amazing Annie Gray, who has done research into the life and types of food that Georgina made. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Hello! Welcome back to Betwixt the Sheets. It's only Annie Gray.
Well, hey, thank you for inviting me back again.
Just had so much fun talking to you about Queen Victoria's eating habits that I knew I had to have you back. And today we're talking about Churchill's eating habits. Why not?
Well, I seem to specialise in sort of slightly problematic, somewhat odious, big eating characters.
Nice. Why Churchill? What attracted you to this person and what he ate?
Essentially, having written about Victoria and Victorian food, I thought, wouldn't it be lovely to take that story a bit further on and look at 20th century food and also domestic service? Because there's a lot of books about servants. There are an awful lot of programmes about servants. There's a lot of Downton Abbey effect and not a lot of understanding about the complexities of servant life and domestic life. So domestic service notoriously was the biggest employer of women, which means to me that you cannot divorce the history of women from the history of domestic service. You've got 31% of women employed in domestic service, and most women go through that, whether it's just working as a char or working in house or whatever. So what I wanted to do was talk about 20th century food, domestic service. All these ideas were milling around in my head, but I couldn't actually come up with an idea to pull them together. And then I was in an archive, and that thing you do, I mean, certainly as a writer, I do it, is I need inspiration. I'm going to go to an archive and I'm going to stand there and I'm just going to kind of wait for something to hit me. And I was pulling books out going, no, not inspiring. No, no. Oh, what's this? And I found this book called Recipes from Number 10, written by Winston Churchill's cook. And I thought, gosh, how interesting. But I'm sure someone's written about her because it's a really obvious topic. Given there are 1,000 biographers of Churchill, someone will have covered his cook. So I went off and I couldn't stop thinking about her because I thought, gosh, you know, that is a person who's got a real hook for the public, who clearly ate a lot, who was right at the thick of things. What was he eating? What was? So I did some research into her and discovered nobody had written about her, but her granddaughter was still alive. So I got in contact with her granddaughter, a lady called Eddie Brocklesby, who is Britain's oldest Ironman competitor and is amazing. And she said, yeah, I'd love you to write about my grandmother. I've tried and I can't find any information out. So if you can do better than me, please have a go. Here's my family archive, such as we've got. This is what we know. She was absolutely just so welcoming. So I went away and deep dived into Georgina Landemar's life, and it was fascinating. So the Churchill part of it is kind of partly a hook. So it's about her, and Churchill's kind of the way in. So it's kind of a, you think you want to know about Churchill, but secretly I'm going to tell you all about the life of this incredible woman who reflects the lives of women everywhere in the 20th century, who, by doing so, reflects the lives of all of our ancestors. So it's really about all of us.
It's a very clever way in to not necessarily Churchill's life, but his way of life. And there's been loads written about him, but it's sort of like bringing out this part of his experience that we don't know very much about, and certainly shining a light on this woman whose name I'd never heard until I knew I was going to be talking about you.
No, and I think that's such a shame because, I mean, there's a biography of his constituency party chairman, for God's sake. People are obsessed with Churchill. You know, every 10 years there's a new biography of Churchill, and there's a limit to what you can say. But he is interesting and he is very problematic and he is larger than life. And you know, he gets voted as Britain's greatest person a lot. And you think, But most people, I think, in the street know him as the wartime prime minister. They don't realise that he had a career before that. They don't realise he got into office again in 1951 when he almost certainly had dementia. They don't know a lot about him. And what they do know comes from this kind of very legend style idea of him, films like The Darkest Hour and all those kind of things. So they've all got this image of him. And I think actually when you look at his food, when you look at how he treated his servants, when you look at the household setup, well, the big thing you start to realise is that, yeah, there's Churchill, like him, loathe him, whatever. There's no denying that he did lead the country in a time of terrible war and he did do some great things for a period of about 4 years. But how easy is it to do great things when you've got a support team? I could be writing millions of books if I had someone doing my laundry and cooking for me and picking up my pants and running my bath. And, you know, it's that idea that behind every great person lies an enormous team. And it's that I wanted to get at, to shed some light on the way it worked.
I don't know about that. I think some of our recent prime ministers have been absolutely useless. I'm sure they had teams of people behind them.
Oh, I'm not saying having a team makes you great. Okay. I mean, I would agree with you that you can have a huge team, but you've got to have the right team. And you also have to have, you know, things like intelligence and charisma and, you know, morals, small things that many of our latest prime ministers seem to have lacked a bit of.
Right. Let's talk about this woman herself, Georgina Landemar or Landemeyer.
Georgina Landemar. So her husband was French. She was born Georgina Young, so much plainer.
Okay, Landemar. Oh, I like it. I like it. Right, so tell me, what is her origin story then? Where does she come from?
She's unbelievably typical. That's one of the things I found really lovely about her. She's all of our grands, or great-grands, or great-great-great-grands, depending on how old you are if you're listening to this. So she was born in 1882 in a village called Oldbury, which is sort of on the border between Berkshire, Buckinghamshire, around there. Today, it's this kind of bougie commuter village where you go into it, there's a village green and there's a cute little shop and there's a station about 3 miles down the road. So she was born there. She was the eldest of five. Her mum had been in domestic service. Her father was a coachman. He worked for very wealthy individuals, and obviously her mother had given up work because she was busy pumping out babies and all the rest of it, and moving with her father as well, who was a coachman, shuttled a lot between London and Berkshire and then across to Wales at one point as well. You know, so far, so absolutely typical, rural, working class, very much the respectable working class that we don't hear a lot about, I think, as historians. We often talk about people in poverty, and that's about a third of the population at the time, and we hear about the rich, and we often hear about the middle classes, but that sort of slice of nearly a third of the population who were just respectable working class, just getting on with it, is a really sizable part of the community, and that's where she is. They don't have the vote at this point because they don't have any property qualifications. They're just, they're kind of the backbone. She ends up living in London for a long time because her father gets a new job in London. So they go and they live near Gloucester Road Queue Station, which is now, I think, a shopping centre, but at the time was a set of mews. So they lived above the coach house. And it was so achingly typical, you know, she went to school till she was 12, and then she left school, and then they changed the rules about when you had to go to school till, so she went back for a bit, and she said she quite liked school, and then she left school, and she didn't know what to do, so she did some nannying work for a little bit. I mean, bear in mind, she's 14.
Christ, that's scary, isn't it? 14.
I know, you think she's 14, oh my God. And then her family had a stern word with her and said she needed to settle down to a career. So she ended up getting a job as what she called a number six in Kensington Palace Gardens, which is a number six in the kitchen, so the lowest of the low. But in a really rich household, the idea of having six people in your kitchen straight off, you go, right, okay, this is a significant household. And what's really interesting about her is that most servants worked in small households. So, you know, we think of servants, especially Victorian, Edwardian ones, and we all think Downton Abbey or big country houses or National Trust. But actually, 75% of women worked in really small households, of one or two servants, middle-class households, and she didn't. She worked only ever worked in really wealthy households, only ever worked in big, nouveau riche, you know, bling-bling money bags households, and she worked her way up through the kitchens in that way, which is an interesting trajectory because just so many people didn't do that, so she was clearly quite determined.
So if she's number six in, like, a really blingy kitchen, even though that's, like, the lowest, would that have been well paid, or is it still shit pay?
It's still shit pay. She's probably on, I don't know, 18, 19, 20 pounds a year, something like that. It's better than many. It's not as good as some. And also, because she's a woman, at that point, she would never have been able to even aspire to earning as much as men. So at that point in time, if you were wealthy enough, you wanted a French male cook. And that was it. You know, if you were a duke of wherever, you want a French man in your kitchen. And if you can't have a French man, you'll have an English man and you'll pay him a little bit less. And if you can't have an English man, you'll have a woman. But you kind of want a woman who's trained under a man cook, because that way it will give you that prestige, preferably a French man cook. So it's ever so, the levels of, oh, well, I'll pay you a bit more because actually you trained under Monsieur, is really infinite. So even when she went into the kitchen she went into, she must have known that she was going to hit. It wasn't so much a glass ceiling as a kind of massive cement fixture held up with iron bars. And that was what most people did, was going to service, although none of her siblings did. All of her siblings went into the new careers that were opening up, so things like design in the case of her brothers, and working at the post office, working in shops, those kind of things. So this is an era, really, 1880s, 1890s, was an era where careers for women were changing quite rapidly, largely because of the number of new jobs in shops in particular, but also in new technologies like telephony and typing and things like that.
So as a number six then, bearing in mind she ends up being a cook, so we'll get there, but what's she doing as a number six? What was your job description as a number six? Was she cooking?
She's a scullery maid at that point, so mainly cleaning, plucking. She kept a memoir, dear old Georgina, which I was very excited by when I discovered it, when I found it. I was given it by her granddaughter, but unfortunately she started writing this thing in the late 1970s when she was in her 90s, and things were not going well at home, so she wrote this memoir longhand, obviously, and then she tore it up and put it down the sink. And it's an amazing document. The 20-odd pages that survive are remarkable. They're so sharp and they're so accurate. And her memory was amazing. So the memoir stops just as she becomes number six. So she says, I was number six and I remember my little tiny copper moulds. And she remembered cleaning tiny copper moulds and also the pull-down bed that she slept on and having to make up the beds for the other maids as well. So she was very much, and would very much have been about preparation, so peeling things, scrubbing things, cleaning things, gutting things, plucking things, breaking up ice would probably have been one of her tasks, to set ice creams and things like that. obviously cleaning pans and generally learning by being around the other maids and by doing basic preparation tasks. You worked your way up, very much learn on the job. And she did work her way up fairly quickly. So she went from number six to then somewhere in the middle by 1901 when she was working for a man called Edward Kilburn. He'd come back over from India. He'd been a colonial administrator, made lots of money and now had this beautiful house just near Paddington, and she was working there for a while. And at that point, she'd kind of worked her way slightly further up. So by then, she was a kitchen maid, so doing lots more cooking. And the normal way it worked was, at some point, you'd start cooking mainly for the servants because they were notoriously picky. So you had to get it right. And then you'd also be doing prep work for the upper table. And you'd learn by doing lots and lots of different things. And the stuff she was cooking was very much Edwardian nouveau riche. So if you can mould it, you mould it. If it looks like what it started off as, it's wrong. In hindsight, we know World War I's going to come and smash it all into oblivion. And you do look at the food and you think, you can kind of see that this is like kind of Rome, just as Nero is fiddling. Because everything is forced to a kind of stupendous visual degree. So to give you an example, I've got a book by Mrs. De Salis, and she was one of these sort of indefatigable Victorian writers. And everything in her book is moulded. All of her entrees, which is the sort of fancy dishes that would sit kind of in about the third or fourth place on the dinner. So if she was going to do, say, I don't know, a tongue dish, she would take a tongue, boil the tongue, push the tongue through a sieve to make tongue puree, mix the tongue puree with a bit of food colouring to bouge it up a bit, add in some gelatin and maybe some more sauces, and then put that into a tongue mould so it looked like a tongue, or possibly a mould with some crossed golf cues on, because why not? And then you demould it, and then you serve it on a bed of, you know, something green. And by the time you finish, you're like, how do I know? I've got no idea what this is. It's why you needed written menus by that point, because there was absolutely no way you could guess what anything was. And it took ages.
This sounds like some nightmare from the 70s. All that salads in aspic and jellied nightmares and all of that stuff. Is that what they're doing?
Yes, but I would say it's better than the 70s. The 70s aspics were basically a direct line back to the Edwardian period, but crap. So you take Edwardian food, everything's beautiful ingredients. You're probably still making your own jelly, or you might be in a really high-end kitchen by boiling calves' feet. You could buy packet gelatin by then. But everything's beautiful and wonderful and very rich. And then you fast forward to the 70s, where everything that can be stripped back has been stripped back, and you buy your aspic in a tin and you just reheat it on the hob and you chuck in some whatever. And suddenly you've got something that's brown with some stuff floating in it, and it looks like the bottom of a pond on a really bad day. And doesn't taste very good either, and is very, very boingy and most people's worst nightmare. But in the Victorian and Edwardian period, that dish would have been genuinely very good, even if you would also have suffered gout a lot, because, yeah.
Wow. Okay, so she's worked her way up to senior cook, making jellies and mousses and other remoulded goods.
And everything. I mean, you know, roasting things, plucking things and putting wings under bodies and your truffles coming out of your ears. And food was incredible. It was what was known as recherché food, which was sort of something new and exciting. It would be the equivalent, I suppose, of just learning to do molecular cuisine today and spending your time with syringes doing really cutting edge stuff, but that did taste good. There were exhibitions put on so that you could learn how to make the best kind of turtle soup and your cooks could go along and train. And it's a fascinating world.
Was it usual for a woman to be a cook at this point? Because we do that, like, cooking is a woman's business. We've been blogging the kitchen, blah, 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 all that shite. There's like a real thing about cooking being gendered. And yet, when we're talking about like chefs, that suddenly seems to be quite masculine. In fact, even today,
go to Google image search and put in chef, you'll get mainly pictures of men. Put in cook, you'll get mainly pictures of women. It is very gendered. So domestic cooking inevitably has often fallen to the woman, because the woman's role is to have children and then look after the children and then do all the domestic tasks. So cooking, the preparation of food, has often fallen to women, usually fallen to women in a domestic context. And that's still true today. So if you look at statistically, even in liberated households, the woman, especially when there are children involved, will do most of the quotidian cooking. And the man might breeze in on a Saturday night and cook some highfalutin thing and leave the washing up everywhere. And yes, that's a gender stereotype, but it's all statistically true. The same with barbecuing, when men like to poke the fire and, you know, actually don't produce anything edible because somebody else has had to produce a salad. Feel my cynicism. But at a professional level, it's always been men. In medieval period, you wouldn't have found a woman in a professional kitchen at all. And you don't really get women in professional kitchens until the 17th century, because they're cheap. So they start to creep in. And they've been in inn kitchens and things like that. And you've often had cases where, say, a man is an innkeeper and his wife might be doing the cooking, because it's just an extension of his home, really, at that point. But in terms of domestic professional kitchens, no women. You see that especially in the royal level. So there are no women in the royal kitchens until I think about 1816. That's when the first woman starts work at the lowest level in the royal kitchens. And by the time Georgina starts cooking, the 1880s, Queen Victoria's kitchens still have, you know, a staff of 45, of which 15 are women, and they're all at the low levels. You cannot get higher. So in the wealthiest of kitchens, it's all still men, because men can cook better than women, and men don't have any wives and children or anything like that to distract them, and it's all about the man. But most people couldn't afford a man, or they brought a man in just occasionally as a jobbing cook, and they did have women. So anyone who was a baron or below really probably didn't have a male cook. So by the 1880s, 1890s, the vast majority of cooks were women, except if you were titled. Anybody who's sort of above an earl, you kind of assume a man in the kitchen. And when Georgina met her husband, Paul, who was a French chef, he had done exactly that. He'd come across from France to cook at the highest level in British aristocratic households and hotel kitchens, which again were all men. So that gender imbalance really was very much there. I mean, again, Downton Abbey, Mrs. Patnall wouldn't have existed. She would have been a man until after the war.
Really?
I mean, I know their finances are dodgy and all that kind of stuff, but they're keeping up appearances. You'd have had a man. After the war, once they'd gone, no, sorry, we lost all our money. Fine to have a woman. So Georgina made cook in 1905 for a millionaire called Robert Alatini. So fabulously wealthy, because it was all new money, had decided he was going to keep a female cook. Cheaper, didn't have quite so many hang-ups. Had he been old landed money, he probably would have had a man. But she made cook in her own right in this household that wanted this sort of very fancy, recherché, incredibly intricate, very lovely Edwardian cookery. But there's no way she could have made the leap to work for aristocrats at that point, because she didn't have the French training that she would have needed.
I'll be back with Annie after this short break.
This is After Dark, myths, misdeeds, and the paranormal.
The podcast that takes you to the shadiest corners of the past, unpicking history's spookiest, strangest, and most sinister stories. I'm Maddie Pelling.
And I'm Anthony Delaney. Join us every Monday and Thursday, and we'll take a look at the darker side of history, from haunted pubs to Houdini to witch trials and arsenic-laced breakfasts.
Follow After Dark, myths, misdeeds, and the paranormal wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when using messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage. Add unlimited photos and videos and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AURAframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, Would it have boosted her credentials, the fact that she married a French chef? That she could just be like, yes, I have got my ovaries with me today, but I am married to this French chef person. Therefore, you must pay me more money.
Yeah, I mean, even she said that being married to a French chef meant that she could train at the footsteps of a master, as it were. And I'm sure it was a love match because he was 23 years older than her. So he was, I think, a year older than her dad. And already had a load of children from his first marriage. So he was born in Paris in the 1850s, lived through the siege of Paris. I don't know whether he ate elephant or not. Classically trained on what I would call the fast track French chef career path. So he did his apprenticeship. He then went and worked in Nice, and he worked in the resorts of northern France, and he worked in restaurants in Paris, and he was clearly going places. And then he stopped going places. First of all, had a child, then got married, legitimising the child as he did so. And then at some point sort of stopped being on the fast track, and clearly his career had stopped for whatever reason. So he came over to the UK, as a lot of French chefs did, and started working almost certainly in hotels. He also worked at Clumber Park as well, the Duke of Newcastle, quite a long time. And then he ran a boarding house, and then his wife died, and a few months later, no more than 3 months later, he married Georgina. So that suggests a strong love match and also something dodgy that I don't want to think about.
We'll move swiftly past that one then.
Oh yeah, she was younger than his daughter. Anyway, but all his children left home by this point.
It's all gone a bit Leonardo DiCaprio, hasn't it?
Well, it's very Victorian. Whenever you read Victorian romance novels, there's always some older man who's quite clearly revolting and hoary, and then this sort of 18-year-old nubile female who's like, I love you. And the older man goes, there's nothing wrong with this. So anyway, she married him. She had a child called Marcel in 1913 who died very soon after birth, which obviously was horrible, tragic. And then she later on had a daughter who did survive. But they don't seem to have been particularly focused on children. Assuming he wasn't firing blanks by that point, you know, he had had quite a few before, so he was clearly quite virile. But whether they were using contraception, whether he was getting older, whether they didn't want children, whatever, they only had one surviving daughter. And they seem to have worked together as a unit. So at this point, I think they went freelance. And it's quite difficult to tell because researching working class women's hard anyway. And in the 20th century, there's just no trace of them. So she seems to have been working with him as a catering team. There's one really tantalising photograph of them in a country house kitchen somewhere, probably in southwest London. And it's a photocopy of a picture. The original no longer exists because it was sent to the Times a long time ago, so 15, 16 years ago, to use for an article, and they never returned it. And they're in a kitchen, and there's Georgina, looking kind of pugnacious and fighty, and her husband with his enormous moustache, and then two completely random people who presumably are their assistants. I'm assuming it's a coming-of-age party or a supper or something of that ilk, you know, maybe a wedding, and the photographer has gone to snap a picture of the caterers, and that's what it is. So later on she said, yeah, absolutely, it did her no harm whatsoever, but she did very obviously learn the French repertoire from him. They went over to Paris to visit his family a few times. He introduced her to lots of people that she needed to know, that kind of thing. He was very well connected, and she learned a lot at his side, and they continued to work together until 1932, when, rather unsurprisingly, given the cigar scenario, he died of lung cancer.
Oh, that's a bit sad.
I mean, it can't have been unexpected, given the age gap.
Just as I was saying that, I was like, yeah, but they are all dead now, Kate. It was going to happen eventually. But so how does she end up working for Churchill then? How do these paths collide?
Well, after Paul died, she clearly thought to herself, what am I going to do? Am I going back in-house? I don't think I want to do that. I mean, you know what it's like once you've tasted a bit of freelance life. You don't want an employer again. She could earn more as a jobbing cook as well, because she would have been able to charge per gig rather than be on a set salary. So she went off to go and be a society chef. And by this point, post-First World War, times have changed. Women much more accepted as leading society chefs by now. So she started cooking for the Churchills for the first time, I think 1933. And by this point, she was cooking for loads of people in their set.
Is she getting quite a name?
Yes. By this point, she's the person you want to cater your thing. So she did the occasional weekend for them. She did the occasional week for them if their main cook was away. Churchill was not a poor man. He was basically an Edwardian with a lot of money, Edwardian semi-aristocrat. But he always spent more than he earned. So if he was given a book advance, he would spend it five times before he'd started writing the book. And that was a bit awkward because it meant he had no money, but the promise of lots of money. So they employed really crappy cooks, often young girls, and Clementine Churchill, Winston Churchill's wife, would sort of train them up. And she was very good. She knew her way around a cookbook because her own mother had led this sort of bizarrely rackety life where they moved to Dieppe to get away from her violent father. And her mother had done a lot of cooking and written cookery columns for newspapers and that kind of thing. So Clementine knew how to cook. And she said she'd spend a lot of time at sort of debutante balls studying cookbooks so she could think of dishes. But they couldn't retain servants because they were terrible employers. They didn't pay very much. And they were really scathing about their servants. And actually, some of the ways they talk about their servants in letters, especially to a modern viewpoint, are really quite nasty. But I think what happened was, like so many people, they had a crappy cook most of the time. And then when they wanted to push the boat out, they got in the caterers. And they would either employ Gunters, who were one of the big London caterers, or they would employ an actual cook to do all the meals if it was a weekend house party. And that's where Georgina came in. But they couldn't really afford them. There was one amazing menu book. So the Churchill Archive was obviously the backbone of most of Georgina's story once she started working for Winston Churchill. But in common with an awful lot of archives, especially of this ilk, when the archive was given to the Churchill College and as part of the college set up, this amazing archive was endowed. But the archive is mainly political. But you struggle to find anything about his domestic life, because at the time, in the 60s, people were like, people want to know about the speeches, the war stuff, the man and the war. And did I mention the war? And they didn't want to know about home. Boring things with food. So there would have been a menu book for every single year which detailed what the servants were eating and what the family were eating. Very, very few of them survived. There's a run of them after the war, but there's one before the war, 1936-37. And it's a beautiful document because you've got this sort of very unformed, almost schoolchild-like handwriting of their normal cook, which shows that they were eating things like baked beans on toast for their tea. Which is brilliant. And then suddenly you've got Georgina's handwriting that kicks in. And when I found that book, I was getting really discouraged because I couldn't find anything. I mean, I knew the book would be about evoking a way of life as much as telling Georgina's story, because that was what it was always intended to be. But I wasn't finding her, and it was like, oh my God, I'm just searching through so much stuff and there's just nothing here. And then I opened this book, and then Georgina's handwriting, which is so distinctive, just kind of swam into view, and I just thought, okay, everything's going to be fine, because her menus are in this gorgeous copper plate and all of her menus were in French.
Do you think they were having beans on toast because they really liked beans on toast, or because that's all that their crappy cook could do?
I think it's a mixture of the two. I mean, Churchill liked to talk about how he really liked plain food.
Man of the people, yeah.
Absolutely. And you think, well, you know, it's like Churchill did like to be seen as someone who, as he put it, ate butcher's meat every day. By which he largely meant beef as opposed to game. He liked Irish stew. Well, he genuinely did. But he was also an Edwardian who really liked things that gave him gout. So a lot of plover's eggs, caviar, he loved caviar, you know. So, of course, that's what he wanted to eat. But when you add in a budget that's not great and then a cook who can't cook, you end up with the baked beans on toast. I mean, there's various dietaries in the archive. So he kept suffering from indigestion and wanting to lose weight. So he consults various doctors and they all write to him and say, well, this is what you should eat and this is what you should cut down on, which itself is illuminating because it tells you what he was eating. And obviously he ignores them all. So, you know, he gets told a minimum of red meat at one point, and you can have chicken and you can have white fish and green vegetables and you can have some rye vitas and things like that, and not too much eggs and bacon and ham. And it just adds up and adds up and adds up. So he got this and he clearly looked at it and went, mm-hmm. So he found another doctor to give him another opinion.
Is it true that he had a bottle of champagne for breakfast or similar? Or is that a myth?
He used to have a thing called mouthwash, which was whiskey diluted with lots of soda. And as part of the experiment for this book, so, you know, I like to throw myself into it wholeheartedly. I did eat 1930s food for about a year. And I tried drinking mouthwash. I mean, it's a nice enough drink if you like really, really diluted whiskey. And it doesn't get you pissed. But when you drink it steadily throughout the day and then you kind of go and have half a bottle of wine at lunchtime and then you hit the port. I gave up brandy for a year at one point because somebody bet him he couldn't do it. And because he needed the money, he took the bet. He was, I think, when you look at his alcohol consumption, I don't think there's any doubt that he was an alcoholic. But he was a fully functioning, very lucid alcoholic. So I interviewed one of his last surviving secretaries and she just said, you know, he would not have been able to dictate the stuff he dictated to us at 2 a.m. were he inebriated to the point of not being able to function. And you do get highly functioning alcoholics where it doesn't seem to affect them. And I think that was where he lay.
So we've got Winston Churchill, who is a functioning alcoholic, swigging his mouthwash throughout the day, then moving on to the port. So she's cooking for him at that point, not making his drinks. What about when the war hits? Is he on rations?
Yes, everybody's on rations, but there's rations and there's rations, you know. So when war broke out, Georgina was cooking in Exning House. So it's a new market, and she was catering a big race season. She did a lot of the racing fraternity. So war broke out, obviously all hell breaks loose. They immediately do this thing called the 1939 Register, which for anybody who is listening, who's a genealogist or interested in family history, they'll be familiar with. Kind of like the census without much of the detail. But it shows you where everyone was at a point in time in 1939. The point in time is after a lot of people have already been evacuated. So when you look at the entry for Exning House, you've got Georgina, the housekeeper, and loads of 13-year-old boys. So that must have been fun, because they'd been evacuated from London and they all had lice and there was lots of complaints. You know, you read the local newspapers and they're all like, well, it's great that these children are being evacuated, but they don't know how to eat. They don't know how to use cutlery and they've all got bugs. I think at that point she must have gone, right, I'm pushing 50 by this point. I'm not quite sure what's going to go on, because actually in the last war, which I've already lived through, I know that all my clients basically packed up and moved into the Savoy. I need someone to work for. I'm not ready to retire. I mean, she wouldn't have had much savings anyway. So who can I work for who's going to have a job? And I think she probably looked across at government and went, that bloke there really likes my cooking. I'm writing a letter. So she wrote to Clementine Churchill and basically said, do you want to cook? And Clementine Churchill clearly thought, oh my God, we can't afford this woman. Our own cook's just gone off. She's just taken off to go live with her daughter. This woman will be amazing. And Winston Churchill knew the power of a dinner party. He knew how to get people into a room and network. And he'd used dinners throughout his career, whether it was at the Savoy or whether it was at home, in order to forge the networks that he needed as a politician. And he was very, very good at doing that. She was a very, very good cook, obviously. So it match made in heaven. And Clementine said she knew that Georgina would be able to make the best of the ration so that everyone, in inverted commas, everyone would be happy. And that's what happened. So the way it worked was that, yes, the Churchills were rationed. In fact, everyone in the household was rationed. So if you had a household of more than one person, everyone would pool their ration books. So Georgina had, I don't know, 7 or 8 ration books, which were the Churchills and the main servants. So she would go along to the registered place and she would pick up meat ration. And it would be the meat ration for everyone. So she brings them all home, looks at them all, and then works out what to cook for the family and also for the servants. Then there were coupons, which came in a little bit later. So the coupons, you could choose whether to spaff 12 coupons on a beautiful tin of tuna or 2 coupons on a really crappy tin of something that was maybe not really even fish. And then there were unrationed things. And then there were diplomatic rations and allowances for diplomacy and for diplomatic dinners. And then there's the grey area, which everybody went through and everybody always will go through, and that wasn't illegal and that wasn't a problem, but slightly different if you were Winston Churchill than if you were Mrs. Smith who lived in Thetford. And that's the area where it comes to people giving you things and swapping you things and what you can grow. So if I was to grow my own, you know, I might dig up my front lawn and I might put down some potatoes and lettuces. Well, you know, Churchill has Chartwell, which was mothballed for the war, but it did have quite a large market garden. And he had Chequers, which also had its own gardens. And, you know, my friend up the road might say to me, I've got a spare rabbit because I've been breeding them. Shall I swap it for a parsnip? And I might go, great. And Churchill was mates with the king, who used to send him sides of venison on the train from Balmoral. So it's just a question of degree, really. There was certainly no meat shortage. Churchill never even noticed the fact that meat was rationed. You read the stuff that people are eating in number 10 and in the annex to number 10, which was built to house him so that it was slightly more bomb-proof. And it's things like fresh peaches and honey, which obviously come from the beehives at Chartwell, and the peaches come from the market garden. Endless fresh eggs, because he got things like school children who kept flocks of hens were all sending him eggs, each of them with their names on, because Mr. Churchill was winning the war, so here are some fresh eggs.
Oh, that's quite sweet.
It's really sweet. Everyone else is living on dried eggs. But I think if you'd asked anybody in the country, and certainly this happened towards the end of the war, if you'd said to them, is this fair? They'd have gone, of course it is. This man is winning the war for us. This man is stopping us being invaded by Hitler. And therefore we owe him. So we're going to send him our fresh eggs, and we're going to send him gifts of raisins. I mean, gifts poured in throughout the whole war. And of course things from America. So he'd get crates of oranges that had come across on the US Air Force.
My, how times have changed.
Yes. And then after the war, when rationing got worse, you know, 1946, bread and potatoes went on the ration for the first time, which hadn't been rationed during the war. But after the war, the Americans pulled out of the lease-lend agreement, so they stopped supplying us with cool things like Spam, because there was this idea that the defeated nations needed to be fed and not fall into poverty, which is quite right, because one of the problems after the First World War was that actually defeated nations were treated so badly, they then reacted against it. And there's a sort of stat around Vienna, which is that the average calories that people could access per day was 700 calories a day. in the aftermath of the war. So at that point, it was like, you know what, Britons, you've got enough calories. You're getting 3,000 calories a day, even if you don't like it because it's mainly potatoes. These people are starving to death. We don't want them to revolt. So at that point, a lot of British aid, a lot of American aid went to rebuilding Germany, rebuilding Austria. And you had a lot of people moaning in their diaries saying, we have won the war. Why is it that we're worse off now? And that was certainly a really true feeling. So after the war, rationing was felt a little more by Churchill. But then people started just sending him gifts saying, oh, my God, you saved us. Here, have some raisins. And you could sponsor parcels to be sent to people. If you were an American, you could pay money and have a parcel made up and it would be sent to a starving English person. And sometimes that starving English person was Winston Churchill. But lots of people wrote and said, we owe you this. We're prepared to go without because you saved us. And therefore, please have this food. And there is a real sense of gratitude. But there's also a sense of the fact that he couldn't turn anything down. So he got his fingers slapped when he was in Downing Street for never saying no to a gift because it caused quite a lot of embarrassment at various points.
I bet. I mean, you're on some dodgy ground there, as we have discovered of recent years, is accepting gifts.
It is, but there's a sense that there wasn't anything he wouldn't accept. During the war, he was told roundly to stop accepting cigars because there was a point where people suspected he might get poisoned by dodgy cigars. You know, it'd be very easy.
That's a fair point.
Really easy for a Nazi agent to put cyanide in a cigar, send it to Churchill, because he chewed the ends as well, so he would have pulled that in. But then they started saying, well, we'll test them. We'll give them to some dogs to smoke.
Give them to a poor person.
Well, that was what they came up with as a solution. And I'll be fair to Churchill. He said, look, if I'm not allowed to smoke them, I don't think it's fair to give them to a convalescent home full of soldiers. So they just got sent back. Because you're reading it and it's such a farce. There's this amazing bit with a Stilton that got sent down from Manchester and Churchill obviously accepted it. And then the storekeeper who gave it to him put a sign in the window saying, Stilton, as enjoyed by Mr. Churchill. And someone wrote to Downing Street, went, hang on a minute, like no one's got any cheese. This is not fair. So they dispatched this kind of crack team up to Manchester to go find out what was going on with this cheese. And then the building got bombed, so no one found out what was going on with the cheese. But after that, he was told to stop accepting random gifts of cheese. He didn't, because there's a brilliant bit with one of the secretaries right at the end of the war. V-Day is coming very, very soon. Everyone knows it's over. And she just spends the whole day just carving up bits of Stilton to give to people. And it's just this endless Stilton-induced nightmare in Downing Street.
It's a cheese fog.
It was just, I was like, yeah, Stilton. Strangely, that's the symbol of the book, Stilton.
I love that. We should keep talking about Georgiana, shouldn't we? So she's got no shortage of ingredients to work with.
No, not really. I mean, she does, in that ingredients are rationed, and also, as Clementine said, they needed to be seen to be adhering to it as well, because it wasn't fair otherwise.
Follow the spirit of the rules.
They were within the rules, absolutely within the rules. And Georgina always said, you know, anyone could have come down at any point and said to her, I need to weigh your butter to check you haven't got too much. And she was really moral, but corners were cut. The portions were small. There were all sorts of things as well, you know. So Churchill wanted to use the dining room at Downing Street an awful lot, but obviously it kept getting bombed. So they used to cook in the annex, which is over the road, which is now the first floor of the Treasury building. So her kitchen was actually where the ladies' loo is now. They'd make these stews and then she'd be driven round. It's only 100 yards, but she'd be driven round like carrying stews wrapped in shawls to unload them at Downing Street because they wanted to use that dining room to prove that they were undefeated and they were not going to be defeated by Hitler. And the kitchen was bombed at one point as well at Downing Street when she was cooking in it.
I'll put a dampener on it.
Well, I'm ruining the pudding, according to her. So it's the only bit where she appears in Churchill's memoir. And it's brilliant because he tells the story of, you know, the bombs are about to fall, the sirens are going. He marches magisterially down to the kitchen and there's the cook toiling among her pans. And he says, Mrs. Landemar, you must go to the shelter. So she goes to the shelter and they come back up. But the kitchen is a bomb, literal bomb site. There's rubble everywhere and he has saved her life. And he even says he had a premonition from the heavens or something. And she told the story much later. She was interviewed by Jane Bakewell. And she just goes, yeah, you know, I was making a pudding. Couldn't turn it out. And Jane Bakewell's going, hang on, the bomb. Bombs are falling and you didn't want to leave your pudding. And she's going, no, well, you couldn't really. It's like a souffle. And she comes up, she's like, there's rubble everywhere. It was awful. But I have cooked the pudding and it is a really nice pudding. And I can sort of see, you know, you get a bit blasé after a while. There's bombs going on, but this thing's rising.
Oh, you probably would, wouldn't you? Was she, like, friendly with the Churchill family?
No, she was. I think once you've lived through 4 or 5 years of bombs falling and really nasty warfare and stress at this incredibly high level, you come out of that and you either hate each other or you're bonded for life. So by the end of it, she was known as Mrs. Marr. She was very, very good friends with Mary Churchill, the Churchill's youngest daughter, later Mary Soames, who she taught to cook and gave her one of Paul Landemar's cookery books to teach her. So it was always a servant and employer relationship. So when she finally left, largely through ill health, you know, she was given the pension by the Churchills that never rose, despite the fact that interest rates and everything else did, but it was £2 a year all the way from 1956 to 1978. That's fine. And the state pension went up quite a lot in that time. So it was an employer-employee relationship. But on the other hand, after Churchill's death in particular, Clementine Churchill used to drive over to Georgina's granny flat where she lived above her daughter's garage, and used to go over and they used to have chocolate cake and watch TV together. So it was as close a relationship as it could be given the period in which they lived and the status with which they had, I would say. And certainly Georgina, she always said that she looked upon her time with Churchill as her war work. And she used to tell a beautiful story, and it's in one of the secretary's diaries as well, where the sort of infamous occasion when Churchill's on the balcony giving his VE Day speech and everyone's sort of screaming and crying and all the rest of it, and he turned away from that balcony to go back inside, you know, massive congratulations, Mr. Churchill, and she'd just come up from the kitchen just in time to hear the end of the speech, because inevitably she was cooking, and apparently he broke away from the people surrounding him and came rushing over to her and shook her hand and said, I could not have done this without you.
Aww.
And that's a lovely thing, you know, you think for all his faults, that is a very human, very noble thing to do, actually, in some ways. At that moment in particular, when he must have been on a high because he's just given this speech and the whole thing is finally over. And she talked about having a number of occasions where he would show the humanity, I think, picture on the wall where he'd point at them and say, I saw those boys go off and they didn't come back. So she saw the stress that he was under and I think became very, very attached to the family. So she kept cooking for them until 1956, well into her 70s. And that bond was very, very strong.
My final question to you, although I could talk to you for forever and ever, is what happened to her? She retired and then she just spent her retirement eating chocolate cake?
Well, she was forced into retirement. She really didn't want to retire, but she had diverticulosis. She put on loads of weight. She went on holiday, you know. And there are letters from Winston Churchill to Clementine saying, oh, Mrs. Landemar has just been on holiday and I hope it's done her some good. She's been away for 9 days. And so she sort of got forced to retire through ill health. And then the cook that replaced her wasn't very good and used Bovril in the gravy. So Georgina kept having to come back and kind of cater occasions. And of course, Churchill got kicked out of office in 45 because basically the nation wanted the beverage report to be enacted well and good NHS and welfare state to be put in place. And I think always Churchill was associated with the war. Everybody wanted to change, bring on the new. They always blamed it on returning soldiers. But then he came back into office in 1951, so she came back with him, and she loved it because she came back and everyone was like, Georgina Landemar! Oh, Mrs. Landemar, you're back! And, you know, her grandchildren used to come visit and they kind of go around the house, and she was respected, and all the children of the people she'd cooked for in this very long career used to come down to the kitchen and say, oh, hi, how are you? And it's all lovely. So she retired, bummed around for a bit, sort of being really quite unhappy. She lived with her brother for a while. He trained his parrot to shout at her, apparently. And then she ended up living above her daughter and son-in-law's house in Stanmore. It was quite a tense relationship with her daughter. So her son-in-law was very staunchly Labour, as was her daughter by this point. So there's a very awkward occasion when Clementine Churchill rang up and said, I've got this spare TV, do you want it? I've just been given it, because it was a programme about Churchill on TV. She said, I've got a colour TV, I'll bring it over. And Georgina said, brilliant, brilliant, OK, yeah. And went downstairs and sort of said, oh, this TV's coming. And her daughter went, oh, do you think maybe you should wait like a week? Because this is like the Labour Party HQ, so the entire house is red. Just saying, awkward. And Georgina became very right-wing. She was very staunchly pro-Churchill and pro-Tory, and politically they were quite at odds. And also, because she'd worked the whole way through Yvonne's childhood, Yvonne had largely been brought up by Georgina's own mother, so it was a strange relationship, I think. And then it got to sort of 1978, and everyone's dying. And Clementine Churchill was finally dying by this point as well. Again, very, very long life. And she sent her last Christmas cards and then died. So Georgina got a Christmas card from Clementine Churchill after knowing that Clementine Churchill was already dead. And her granddaughter said that she was in the old people's home by this point that Georgina had been put in, and she just watched her cry. Georgina's daughter was by now dying of breast cancer. Her son-in-law was very ill as well. And it was a really horrible, unhappy time. She'd gone into an old people's home because she had cataracts. She was still bright as a button, but frail. And then she died in 1977, when Clementine died, really of old age. She was 96 by that point, so a good long life. And I think no regrets as well. She would tell certain selected stories over sherry and have all of the nurses in stitches. So I think it's one of those things where you think this is a very long life, well lived, but one that really went under the radar, because she didn't write her memoir, she didn't publish the memoir, and people by that point were being very dismissive of domestic service. This was the era of upstairs, downstairs, and reassessing domestic service, and all of those misery memoirs that came out at that point, where people wanted to distance themselves from that era. And actually, I think there's so much to celebrate with her life. And people say to me sometimes, oh, well, servants, they're like slaves, aren't they? Really not. Like, so not that I can't even begin to explain how not so that is. It denies servants agency in a way that I think is very reductionist. I don't think it is fair to say you're a servant, you do not have agency. Of course you do. You can leave. You can get another job, especially in the 20th century. And now I think we've reassessed that idea and we've come to realise that there's a lot more complexity. Therefore, I was able to write this book kind of thing and do it in a way that showed the nuances of her own life.
Annie, you've just been amazing to talk to again. And if people want to know more about you and your work, and they should, quite frankly, where can they find you?
I do have a website, but better is probably Instagram or Twitter, where I'm at Dr. Annie Gray. And the book's Victory in the Kitchen, The Life of Churchill's Cook. It's got a beautiful pink cover, which is a kind of homage to Georgina's cookbook.
Until next time, thank you so much, Annie. You're an absolute superstar. Thank you for listening, and thank you so much to Annie for joining me again. I have so much fun talking to her. And if you like what you've heard, please don't forget to like, review and subscribe wherever it is that you get your podcasts. And if there's something that you desperately want us to look into, if you have a burning question, or if you just want to say hello because you've had a few too many sherries while listening to the podcast, then you can now email us. Oh yes. You can email us at betwixt@historyhit.com. Join me again betwixt the sheets, the history of sex scandal in society, a podcast by History Hit.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.